Ave, and welcome to Emperors of Rome, a podcast about the rulers of the ancient Roman Empire. I'm your host, Matt Smith, and with me today is Dr. Paul Burton, a senior lecturer in the Centre for Classical Studies at the Australian National University in Canberra. This is episode LXXVIII, Borders of the Roman Empire. The borders of the Roman Empire have moved throughout its history, reaching their greatest extent during the years of Trajan. How the Romans viewed and managed their provinces changed with the politics of Rome, and their relationship with outside powers influenced what it meant to be a Roman. Here's Paul Burton.
Well, we have lots of random quotations from lots of different authors working in different genres across long spaces of time that often get thrown around by modern scholars. So, for example, one of the most famous belongs to Virgil, who says in the Aeneid, "Rome's mission was to impose civilization on peace, to extend mercy to the submissive, and to crush the intransigent utterly in war." So, different strokes for different folks, I suppose. Those who submit to Roman power receive clemency. Those who refuse to submit and keep fighting on have to be crushed, destroyed completely. Cicero, who is the great Republican writer, orator, and politician, he says that Rome established a protectorate over the entire world by defending its allies and provinces with justice and good faith. So a sort of soft power approach, which to some extent under the Republic, which is what he's talking about, is true, and I'll probably say more about that later. The flip side of this, the Roman writer Tacitus, who's writing under the emperors Trajan and Domitian, 80s, 90s, in the early 2nd century CE, he puts in the mouth of a Caledonian chieftain, a chieftain in Scotland named Calgacus. This is a very famous quotation. You may have heard it before. "The Romans, using false names, call rapine, plunder, and slaughter empire, and where they make a desert, they call it peace." So the desert as peace is often thrown around, even by Australian prime ministers, I think.
So it sounds like Rome, from their perspective, was doing the world a favor with its actions by imposing peace.
Yeah. The origin of the British concept of the white man's burden comes from Roman literature, in which all of these British imperialists of the 19th century were steeped. I mean, they all had experience of that classical education, and that's the takeaway from their classical texts when they were out building the British Empire, is they were giving these poor, benighted others the benefit of British civilization.
So what sort of evidence was there of Roman imperial actions and reactions during the Roman Republic then?
Well, Rome expanded throughout the Italian peninsula during the first three or four centuries of the Republic, but first expanded her imperial sphere overseas during a series of conflicts with the North African state of Carthage. Two major wars were fought with Carthage in the 3rd century BC. The Second Punic War, of course, was fought with Hannibal, who famously crossed the Alps with his elephants. And in the east, Rome fought a series of wars with the Hellenistic kingdoms, the kingdoms that were left behind after the death of Alexander the Great, when his generals divided up his empire into different portions and took control of them. The Romans essentially sought security in a world where they saw threats everywhere. So from the Celts and the Germans in Central Europe, from the Carthaginians south of them in Africa, and from these major Hellenistic kingdoms in the east. Now, whether they were paranoid about their national security to an extreme degree, or whether they used their paranoia as an excuse to go out and conquer the world, there's evidence for both in the ancient sources. But they were peculiar in that they went out especially in the East, in a different way from other imperial powers. They would intervene in dangerous situations, not through the persistent application of force, but they would massively intervene. They would take over tens of thousands of legions, and then they would fight a major pitched battle with whatever enemy, and then they would just withdraw their troops, their attention, and their interest until a situation would flare up yet again that required their intervention. They wouldn't, in other words, annex territory.
Yeah, okay. Was that a standard policy, or is it just they didn't know how to handle the territory if they did annex it?
Being a republican government and having peculiar political traditions whereby the Romans were really small government type people, they didn't have the sort of bureaucratic mindset where you can annex territory and put people in charge of governing it.
Yeah, yeah.
Simply because they believed that putting people in positions of power and in control of troops for years on end was a danger to the republican system, that it could create pockets of potential abuses of power. And so they didn't want to annex territory because they didn't want to privilege particular members of their political establishment by putting them in charge of that territory. And so they tended to manage their overseas interests through making friends, international friends, with local rulers, elites, and states. So they left them to sort of manage things for them.
The King Attalus III.
Oh, yeah. King Attalus III was the king of Pergamum, which is in what is today central Turkey. A very wealthy king, actually. This is a good example of what was happening in the late Republic with several different states, actually, who willed their kingdoms to Rome. A king of Egypt tried to do this. It didn't come off, though. It wasn't successful. But King Attalus III, when he died, when his will was read, bequeathed his entire kingdom to Rome. There's debate about why he did this, possibly to protect his kingdom from encroachment by various enemies in the region. But in any case, this was in 133 BCE, and Rome accepted the will, and that became the province of Asia.
So it was a sign of the regard that other states held Rome in at the time, I suppose.
Yeah. The kingdom of Pergamum, Attalus's kingdom, had been a Roman friend since at least 209 BC, so almost a century at that point. So, and Rome had stable, good relations with Pergamum.
So how did new territory join the empire then? How did that end up happening?
Under the Republic, new territory generally fell to Rome as the spoils of victory. And it was all always very close to home. And they had to improvise a solution to the problem of annexation. And so, you know, the first territories that become Roman provinces are the islands surrounding Italy itself, Sicily, Sardinia, Corsica. And they fall to Rome largely through the wars with Carthage. Spain also falls to Rome because that's where the Carthaginians were building up an empire. And so in order to deal with the problem of personnel, they send out governors to these places for stretches of 1 year only, and then they bring them home and replace them with another individual.
Yeah, yeah. That's a way to make sure that they don't get too comfortable there, or they don't build up too much of a power base.
Exactly.
And suddenly pose a threat themselves. So is this how provinces slowly become systemized then?
Yeah, yeah. And one of the problems they encounter is that the only people who can govern provinces have to be able to command troops. They only elect per year six individuals to office who have that power to command troops. So what happens once you go beyond six provinces? You have to improvise solutions to that problem. You can either extend people in their commands longer, but that causes the problem I referred to before, Or you can create new magistrates who have the power to command troops. The problem with that is it cheapens the office, because the prestige with the office is the limited number of people who can hold it, of the senators, of the ruling class. So they decide to go with prorogation, which is just extending the command of the person in office so that they can govern more areas. So people get the power associated with a particular office without holding the office itself. To a lot of scholars, this is one of the reasons why the Republic falls, because you get people like Julius Caesar in Gaul for almost 10 years because his command is simply extended, highly unusually, in 5-year increments. And so you have these people who are away from Rome for a long time. They're not subject to scrutiny. Their behavior is not monitored. They're not accountable to anyone. And they build up a very close relationship with their troops, who are willing to do whatever they request.
Yeah.
Such as, my honor has been insulted by the senators at Rome. Are you with me, men? I'm going to march on Rome and force them to do what I want them to do.
Mm.
And of course, Caesar's troops do precisely that.
So how central was the emperor to maintaining the peace of the empire then?
After Julius Caesar, when Augustus became emperor, one of the things that he promised after decades of civil war was peace. Especially, he meant peace in the provinces. And what this meant was effective frontier defense on those frontiers that were the most problematic. And that meant the far eastern frontier, which had been troubled by the Parthians for a couple of decades, the northern frontier, particularly against the Germans. So those were the places with the highest concentration of troops. He had to put men loyal to himself, preferably members of his own family, in charge of those troops who would maintain loyalty to the regime. And he had to make sure that the provincials were not exploited the way they had been under the Republic by tax gatherers and that sort of thing. So the emperors were crucial to the ongoing well-being of the provincials. Unlike under the Republic, where you had this improvised system of generals going out to the provinces, trying to make a fortune to pay for all of the expense involved in climbing the ladder of offices throughout their career. It became systematized under the emperors. The emperors themselves rarely went out to the provinces, but they sent their best men, their most trusted men, out to the provinces.
Actually, just on that last point, that the emperors didn't really travel.
Yeah.
It occurs to me how much of a big deal it must have been for Hadrian then to go and visit pretty much every province during his reign.
Yeah. The reason for that, I think, is that rolling back all of Trajan's conquests, Trajan was probably the first big conquering emperor since Augustus himself, actually. He died fighting on the eastern frontier, having added multiple provinces to the empire. And he was popular as a result, because bigger is better in the mindset of the ancient people. And having rolled back Trajan's conquests, Hadrian was actually very unpopular among the senators.
Mm.
And so he spent most of his time on the frontiers, probably because he wasn't well liked in Rome. He also didn't have much rapport with the troops. And so going out there and getting to know the troops and setting them to work on other tasks, building aqueducts and things like that, was actually a very smart move on his part.
So as the Roman Empire grew under the emperors, how did attitudes towards the provinces change then? Because I know that at some point, Rome becomes not so much only Italy, and the mindset changes within Rome.
I think under Augustus, really, Augustus marks a sea change from attitudes towards the provinces that, you know, they were seen as things to exploit under the Republic. They were seen as cash cows for the senators to exploit. I think the Emperor Tiberius, Augustus's successor, put it best. he said, "My sheep are meant to be shorn, not fleeced." So the idea is you collect the taxes and the tribute and so on, but you cannot exploit them to the fullest the way they were under the Republic. And what you have in the first 2 centuries CE is you have an explosion of building projects all over the empire, where you have an aspirational elite in the cities of the empire trying to curry favor with the emperor. And how do they do this? By building in monumental terms, building baths, aqueducts, public buildings, and so on, roads, by building these things for their indigenous people and putting their names on them and putting honorific inscriptions and statues up to the currently reigning emperor. Mm. So this kind of local philanthropy by the local big men as a way of currying favor with the Roman emperor and as a way of gaining Roman citizenship and perhaps one day becoming a senator in Rome is a wonderful little system, and it contributes to that civilizing project that we talked about earlier, that idea of civilizing the provincials by giving them what the Romans saw as the quintessential contribution of theirs to civilization, which was urban living.
And finally, you get to the point where you've got somebody like Trajan, who's an emperor not from Italy. He's from Spain.
Yeah.
And his successor is from Spain. And later on, you get emperors from other provinces and from Africa and Croatia way down the track.
Yeah.
So essentially, you know, everyone in Rome is Roman
at
that point, I suppose.
Yeah. Claudius attempted to get the ball rolling in the mid-first century CE. A lot of senators didn't like the idea that he wanted important men from the province of Gaul enrolled in the Senate, and they actually don't appear very quickly, so it seems like the emperor didn't get his way. But Claudius had the vision that I think a lot of Romans had, that you cannot sustain a narrow oligarchic elite in power without drawing from the outside. The Romans had been doing this since the very beginning of the Republic, bringing in Sabines, bringing in Etruscans, bringing in people from all over Italy into the senatorial elite. Augustus, of course, brought all of these Italians into the senatorial elite because the civil wars had extinguished so many Roman senatorial families. So Claudius was thinking in those terms, that you need to continually expand the base of the elite in order for it to continue in power. So by the time you get to the end of the first century CE, you see senators from Gaul and Spain and elsewhere in the Senate.
Yeah.
And you have Greeks coming in by the mid second century, and you have North Africans as well.
So how big does the Roman Empire get? It gets to its largest extent during the reign of Trajan, doesn't it?
That's right. So from Britain in the west to Mesopotamia in the east, to what is essentially Iraq, to North Africa in the south. The eastern conquests are abandoned. It's simply unsustainable.
So during all of this, how does the concept of citizenship change?
Yeah, citizenship is really important. I think what distinguishes the Roman Empire as an ancient empire from the other empires of antiquity is that the Romans have a very robust legalistic concept of citizenship. And what they do is they expand their empire is, unlike most other imperial systems of antiquity, they don't restrict their citizenship as they expand. They extend their citizenship more generously. So it becomes a prized thing, and they incentivize it, obviously. And this is how they encourage loyalty to Rome itself. This is how they encourage people to do favors for Roman governors and things like that. This is how they encourage local important elites and aristocrats to use their money to build cities. They hold out the carrot of citizenship. And Roman citizenship is extremely valuable, as we know, of course, from the example of the Acts of the Apostles in the Bible, where St. Paul is about to be flogged. And, you know, when it comes to it, at the end of it, he just says, Civis Romanus sum, I am a Roman citizen. And at that point, the whole process has to stop, and he has to be sent to Rome to have his case tried before a Roman magistrate.
Yeah,
there's enormous privileges that come with citizenship. And the Romans use that as leverage to gain loyalty and to have the empire run in a way that is congenial to themselves. The citizenship expands throughout the empire until Caracalla, not an emperor that is known for much or much good except for this one thing in the year 212 CE, extends Roman citizenship to everyone in the empire. So the entire empire consists of citizens.
Why did he do that?
People suspect he had cynical motives, that is, to be able to tax everyone in a certain way, but
sure.
Bureaucratic simplicity is probably
a
good enough reason to suspect that's why he did it.
That's Dr. Paul Burton, a senior lecturer in the Centre for Classical Studies at the Australian National University in Canberra. And you have been listening to Emperors of Rome. If you like this podcast, you can subscribe to it in Apple Podcasts and please leave a review there. They help in the podcast rankings and help new people find it. You can follow the Emperors of Rome on Facebook and you can follow me on Twitter. I'm at Nightlight Guy. In the next episode of Emperors of Rome, we'll be hearing about the philosophy Epicureanism. But until then, I'm Matt Smith. You've been fantastic, and thanks for listening.